listeners, and welcome back to the Chamberlain's Lawcast. This is part 2 of 3 surrounding the developments of testamentary trust and asset protection. Today we'll be discussing bankruptcy and asset protection. I'm here again with Stipe Valletta, the head of our insolvency and restructuring team. Welcome back, Stipe. So, Stipe, how are you going today?
Yeah, really well, Cody. How are you going?
Yeah, really good. So, when looking at asset protection and bankruptcy, how exactly are those assets being affected by bankruptcy itself?
Yeah, look, there's two fundamental ways in which assets come under attack in the administration of a bankrupt estate. Assets can be attacked as property in the bankrupt estate, divisible amongst its creditors. So that's what we call divisible property in the industry. And also through voidance provisions, which allow a trustee in bankruptcy to void certain transactions as against a bankrupt to recover assets from third parties and associates. Ultimately, the protection offered by a discretionary trust, whether it's testamentary or inter vivos, is focused on the first line of attack. So how do we consider what is divisible property and how can a bankruptcy trustee get access to it?
Awesome. So you talked about actually considering what is divisible property, but as a definition, what actually is divisible property?
Well, Section 116 of the Bankruptcy Act sets out an exhaustive list of assets which might form property which is available to a bankruptcy trustee for the satisfaction of creditor claims. But ultimately, a short form summary would be all property owned at the time of bankruptcy or acquired during the bankruptcy, any rights or powers over property that existed at the date of bankruptcy or during bankruptcy, any rights to exercise powers over property, any property that vests because an associated entity received the property as a result of personal services supplied by the bankrupt, and any monies recovered from an associated entity due to an increase in the net worth of the entity as a result of the personal services supplied by the bankrupt. And obviously this is, you know, I guess, quite a bit of legal jargon, but what it really hints at is that there's a million and one ways in which a bankruptcy trustee can look at physical property or intellectual property or choses in action available to a bankrupt and consider how they might get access to that property. So you have to look further than the legislation itself to determine how that is. And there's actually a really interesting case from the 1960s. It's called Gartside and Inland Revenue Commissioner. And that case actually says that a beneficiary of a discretionary trust has a mere expectancy and a right to be considered for a distribution, but no right to actual property in the trust. The issue, though, is that over time, this principle has eroded and the courts have been more willing to find property rights exist in certain circumstances. So it's, again, not enough to just look at the legislation, look at your trust deed or look at the testamentary instruments such as the will establishing the trust. You have to look past that and consider the case law.
That's really interesting. Obviously, that's a bit of an older case and you talked about how the principles have eroded over time, but kind of more recently, in the common law, what developments have occurred and what cases are there that are of importance now?
Yeah, of course. Well, I guess by 2006, the general position of the courts was that an interest in discretionary trust was confined to a sole beneficiary of an exhaustive trust. So what that really means is the terms of the trust require the trustee to distribute the whole of the income at the end of a certain period to a particular beneficiary. So the courts really found between the 1960s and 2006 that if the trust deed or the testamentary instrument actually says, hey, you must distribute X amount of income or X amount of capital to a particular beneficiary, then that might be considered or will likely be considered property available to the trustee because it's more than a mere expectancy. However, obviously, there were some drastic changes in 2006, which blew it wide open.
Regarding those then drastic changes, do you mind providing a bit more in regards to that?
Yeah, of course. So there was a really famous case called Richstar arising out of the whole OneTel collapse. And in that particular case, Justice French found that where a beneficiary effectively controls the trustee's power of selection as to income or capital distributions, this power is akin to a proprietary interest held by the beneficiary. His Honour actually highlighted that it was important to distinguish between cases where there was an independent and arm's length trustee from cases where the beneficiary was the trustee or effectively controlled the trust. And so what that really meant was a proprietary interest was defined as it is as good as certain that the beneficiary will receive the benefits of distributions of either income or capital or both. And then it looked past that and say, well, what are circumstances where that isn't as good as certain, or circumstances where the conduct of the trustee is more than arm's length? So, you know, is the trustee an alter ego, for example, of the beneficiary? And that alter ego phrasing is a bit of a buzzword used by industry professionals such as myself when assessing, you know, whether you can bust a trust, if I can put it that way. Look, if you're looking at specific details around, you know, what constitutes an alter ego, Justice French actually indicated some really interesting tests which give you some guidance. So, for example, where a defendant, so a bankrupt beneficiary, is both the beneficiary as well as a director and secretary of a corporate trustee, then that might be considered an alter ego situation. Similarly, where the defendant is a trustee and beneficiary and has discretion over 39% of income or capital to a specific beneficiary, or where the defendant is a beneficiary and appointor of the trust. So those are three specific examples that were handled by the court in those scenarios where they said, hey, if that exists and there's a pattern of ongoing distribution to that beneficiary, then potentially that's an alter ego case and you can bust that trust and consider the income and potentially the capital of that trust as property. It's quite scary, actually, because the effect of Richstar is the trust assets will not be found to be property merely because the defendant is a beneficiary, of course. But if they are a trustee, director, shareholder, corporate trustee, or an appointor, certain combinations of these rights and roles might leave that beneficiary exposed if they do go bankrupt.
So obviously there's a lot of technical kind of issues there that makes all issues of assets and trust in bankruptcy proceedings really, really difficult for someone to assess on the surface. Looking at the importance of Richstar, are there any other cases that have kind of referred to it or used it?
Yeah, of course. Public trustee in Smith in 2008 in New South Wales is a really interesting case because it considered Richstar. And again, only a couple of years had passed, but it was a couple of years of quite heady times in the economy. So it wasn't as if this decision came in the context of, you know, a crisis or drastically changing public sentiment. It was more an evolution of Richstar in a way. And in that case, they said that the disposition of real property by will, where the real property was owned by the trustee of a discretionary trust, the deceased was the beneficiary of the trust, the deceased was the appointor of the trust, and the deceased owned all shares of the trustee and was its sole director, didn't necessarily amount to a distribution which could be attacked by a bankruptcy trustee. So in that case, they actually said not every case of alter ego is one that can be attacked, and it made it very confusing. Ultimately, the court said, and I quote, "I respectfully doubt that it is correct to say that a beneficiary who controls the trustee, what approaches a general power of appointment. In the usual case, as in this case, the power vests in the trustee and is a special power, does not become a general power of appointment merely because the beneficiary can compel its exercise in favour of himself." And in the end, the court concluded that the deceased beneficiary was not the beneficial owner of the trust assets. So unfortunately, the cases have found that it's quite, you know, inconsistent, and it doesn't give a lot of people confidence about how trustees should operate. And ultimately, the advice, at least in a general form, that I tend to give people, whether it's advisors such as accountants or financial planners or business owners or testators, is that you have to look past what it says and you have to look at what you do. And you have to try to establish a hygienic pattern of behavior that shows that you aren't truly the alter ego, that it's not a scam, that it's not a sham, that you're there just discretionarily obtaining income or capital, and that could change, even if it hasn't historically changed.
That's really interesting, Stipe. Obviously, it's a really technical field. Just wrapping up, are there any other issues that are generally considered in relation to this?
Yeah, of course. So there's two other things the Bankruptcy Act does, which we're not going to go into great detail. And I would say if they come up, someone should obtain legal advice straight away. But Section 302B of the Bankruptcy Act specifically avoids trust deeds that seek to cancel, reduce, or qualify a beneficiary's interest in a trust, or allow the trustee to exercise discretion to the detriment of a beneficiary due to the beneficiary committing an act of bankruptcy. So what that really means is that, you know, beneficiaries cannot rely on such provisions to provide asset protection. So, you know, if I'm a discretionary beneficiary under a trust deed and that says, Stitt, if you go bankrupt, you can't, as the trustee, transfer me any more income, that might actually be considered to be void under the Bankruptcy Act. So again, it's about looking past the drafting of what you do and looking substantively at the conduct of the parties. And I guess similarly, extending on this issue, there's a potential effect of pre-testamentary transactions for a deceased estate that goes bankrupt, or alternatively, just pre-trust transactions or trust transactions which might be affected during the time of a trust, which can be voided by the Bankruptcy Act. So under sections 120 and 121 of the Act, certain transactions can be voided if they're made for the purposes of defeating creditors or in exchange for no consideration or for consideration that's less than market value. So that means that when you're looking at how you're getting assets in and out of a trust, or how you're transacting with the income and or assets of the trust, you have to be really careful that you're not putting your foot in it with respect to other wrongs. So you have to make sure that what you're doing is generally bona fides, and that the general transactions you undertake as part of your trust dealings are not going to be set aside otherwise. Because in the end, you might have a properly constituted trust. You might have a protected beneficiary who has asset protection from the trust because you've considered the way it's drafted, because you've considered the conduct of that individual generally, but then they might have done specific transactions which can then be voided for not being bona fides otherwise. So I guess the main takeaway is that there are three levels of advice which need to be given, and it's not enough to just jump online and download an automated trust deed and think that you've done enough.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, there's far too many technical steps to really just take a general piece of advice on the internet. Thanks again, listeners, for joining us. This is part two of our three-part series on developments in testamentary trust and asset protection. We look forward to you joining us for our final part of this series.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. As with all Chamberlain's Law Firm podcasts, the information that you have heard in this podcast is not legal advice and cannot be considered legal advice. If you have any questions or queries, please do not hesitate to contact our office on 02 6188 3600 or otherwise look us up on our website, which is www.chamberlains.com.au.